Hello, I'm Brian Tatler. I'm in Saxon. I'm the guitarist in Saxon, and we're here in Fredrik Strager's apartment here in Stockholm.
Welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
You're not just in Saxon, you're also from Diamondhead.
Yes, I mean initially Diamondhead, but recently I've took over from Paul Quinn in Saxon. So yeah, and I'm here with Biff to do promo for the new album.
And you're from the Midlands town Stourbridge.
Yes, Stourbridge. It's just outside Birmingham, about 10 miles from Birmingham.
It's funny, I only know of Stourbridge because I used to listen to quite a lot of indie pop music in the early 90s. And there were three bands that all came from Stourbridge, I think.
Incredible.
Ned's Atomic Dustbin, The Wonder Stuff, and Pop Will Eat Itself.
Absolutely. I wouldn't have thought you'd have known that, you know, being over here in Stockholm, but because it's quite that was the Grebo sort of style. And yes, Stourbridge punched way above its weight for such a small town.
And those bands were really big. Then they sort of disappeared when Britpop came around, like in the mid 90s. But I remember seeing all those groups at the Hultsfred Festival here in Sweden.
Okay. Yeah, I saw them all in Stourbridge. I mean, they'd just play local pubs and that. And, one by one, they got signed, and they used to ask me things, you know, about advice and that, because Diamondhead had already been going. We'd had a record deal by the, you know. And I always used to wish them well, and I mean, Ned signed to Sony, and I just used to say, try and keep it together, you know, don't split up, keep going. And they did really well, yeah. And in fact, Clint Mansell from Pop Will Eat Itself became a film composer, didn't he? And he's composed like over 50 movies, some quite big movies, like, what's it called? Black Swan. And yeah, so super talented.
It's still a great band name, Pop Will Eat Itself.
Bizarre, yeah.
And it kind of felt, you know, as if they looked into the future, because pop is really eating itself, you know, with all the, like, the retro thing going on. I think that there was a book published in Britain called The Pop Will Eat Itself, or Retromania was the title of the
Rings
book.
Rings a bell.
By, I don't remember the writer, but it's about how pop music is constantly recycling itself.
Yes, and that's true, isn't it, you know.
But you formed Diamondhead back in 1976.
Yes, I did. At school, we were still at school, and my older brother, 6 years older than me, played guitar and sort of got me interested in it all. So, of course, I wanted to do a band, and I just, like, my best friend Duncan was on the drums, and we didn't have a proper drum kit, but we'd had a biscuit tin drum kit, and we, like, a big plastic wine tub for the bass drum, and we made up whatever we could for toms and cymbals and that. And then we had a couple of bass players and settled on Colin Kimbley, who bought... I said to Colin, if you buy a bass, I'll teach you how to play. So he thought that was a fair deal. Bought a £30 K bass and set about, you know, learning. You only need E and A, really, you know. That's an E string, that's an A string. Let's do a gig. I know that's patronising to bass players, but it's a bit of fun.
So your big brother David was a big influence.
Yeah, huge.
What kind of stuff was he into?
Well, he liked all kinds of rock, mainly, you know, sort of white rock. So it would be Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath and all that. But also he was a huge Beatles fan, and he was in the Beatles fan club, and he used to get those fan club flexi discs every year that we used to laugh at and think they were fantastic. And then when they finished the Beatles, they did a proper 12-inch, you know, vinyl, sort of a compilation of the seven Beatles flexi discs, and he got one of those, and that became quite a collector's item.
So flexi discs, the ones that you could like fold, that came in a newspaper.
Yeah, that's
basically
right.
So, and the sound quality wasn't
great, but they released one every year, every Christmas, and they made it up, you know, and they'd make up little songs, and they were fantastic. And if you've not heard them, they're probably on YouTube. But he also liked krautrock, and he took me to see bands. He took me to see Cannes, and he took me to see Amandul. And then I think we went to see 10 Years After and Black Sabbath. Well, he took me to see Black Sabbath at Birmingham Odeon when I was 14. And, you know, big moment for me to see someone like Iommi, you know, playing those giant riffs. So he was a huge influence. I can absolutely remember him. He'd come home with an album like Houses of the Holy or, you know, Dark Side of the Moon or something, and we'd sit and listen to it on my mum and dad's big wooden stereogram machine thing in the lounge. And, I absorbed rock music from the age of probably 12, 13 onwards.
Oh, let the sun beat down upon my face. Stars fill my dreams. I'm a traveler of both time and space to be where I have been. Sit with elders.
This is Kashmir by Led Zeppelin from the album Physical Graffiti. And this is my favourite song by my favourite band from my favourite album, so it doesn't get much better than this for me.
That beat in the beginning, I think, was sampled by Puff Daddy or someone.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
In the late 90s and became quite a big hit.
Yes.
A lot of people have sampled Led Zeppelin.
It's a fantastic groove, isn't it?
The story was quite clear.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
What did your parents work with?
What did they do for a living?
Yeah, were they into music as well?
They liked music. They weren't musicians. My dad we had a piano in the front room, and he used to pick out a few tunes by ear. But nobody in the family could really play piano. My brother played guitar, as I said. My dad was a craftsman, really. He was a tool maker. So that was apparently 7 years apprenticeship, so a real skilled job. And he did that till he retired. And my mom worked...
So a tool maker.
It's called a tool maker.
Okay, so what do you do? Do you make tools?
I believe so. Oh. They would make the initial tool. Like he would use the lathe and various machines. I'd say, we need something to do this job. And he would craft it out of steel. And I would, you know, work out the exact thing they needed to do a certain job. So in a way, you would make something from scratch out of metal. And
Stalbridge is quite close to the area that they used to call the Black Country, where they had a lot of steel mills and glass mills, and basically where the industrial revolution
chain
started.
Chain making as well. Yes. Yeah, Creighton, Cradley Heath, which is a couple of miles away, yeah.
Lots of industries.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely, it was sort of heavy industry, steel and rolling mills and all that. There was a place not far called Round Oak Steelworks, and you could see the blast furnaces, you know, as you went past on the boards or something, there'd be all the fire and sparks coming out. But yeah, all that Birmingham, you know, industrial, was you know, all around me, Black Country.
Did your parents encourage you and your brother to become musicians?
I think they probably tolerated it. I don't think they ever told us it was stupid or waste of time or anything. They were encouraging. They probably didn't necessarily think, oh, yeah, you'll be a big star, you know. I think it's something, isn't it? If you're spending time practicing, at least you can focus on something and you're not annoying the neighbours, you're not running around the streets smashing windows and chasing after girls on motorbikes or something. So it's a nice pastime. Probably the only time they might have regretted it is when I formed Diamond Head. I was still, of course, living at my parents' house, and we used to rehearse in my bedroom right above where my parents were below watching TV. So we'd be up there trying to write heavy metal songs, and they'd be trying to watch the telly, and they'd probably be hearing bum, bum, bum all, you know, for several hours as we had the bass drum going and bass guitar and vocals. But I didn't know where else to rehearse, you know. There was no rehearsal rooms that I could find by me. I mean, apparently some bands would rehearse in a pub or something, but we were only like 16 and we had no money. So we just rehearsed in the house.
Were you good at school?
Was I good? No, I don't think I was. There was this thing called the 11 plus in England. So when you were 11 years old and you were about to go from junior school to senior school, if you didn't pass, they did an exam. And that would sort you out into different schools. And if you're good, you'd go to a grammar school. And if you're not very good or a bit thick, you'd go to like a different school, and like a secondary modern school or whatever they call it. And so I failed my 11 plus, like a lot of kids. And I went off to the school where the teachers weren't particularly good, and I think you're kind of factory fodder, you know. They would encourage you to maybe become a bricklayer or something like that, rather than a doctor. You probably realise, they used to say in my report, he's good with his hands, and so in a way, that's become my thing. As in, I'm a lead guitarist in a rock band, so I'm good with my hands. So they probably worked that out. He's not academic, he's not sharp, but he's good with his hands.
You got the name Diamond Head from the first solo album by Phil Manzera, the guitar player in Roxy Music.
That's right.
Did you listen a lot to Roxy Music as well?
I liked Roxy Music. Again, my brother bought that album, For Your Pleasure. And, of course, they had some big hits. I'd be on Top of the Pops with Pajama Armour and Virginia Plain and Do the Strand and all that. So, yeah, I liked them. But the reason I chose that name, because I just thought it was a good name, and I actually had the poster, because there's a record shop in Stourbridge, and very often when a promotional campaign had finished, they'd throw out the posters, and I'd nick the posters and take them home, and I put them on the wall, even though I'd never heard this album. It had a train on the cover, and it said Phil Manzanera, Diamond Head. And I cut the Diamond Head bit out with a pair of scissors and stuck it on the wall. I thought that'd be a good name for the band, because I'd been trying to think of a name for my band probably since I was maybe, you know, 15 or something, since I started playing Dave's guitar, age 14, 15. And I'd come up with some terrible names.
So, like what?
We had Phoenix once, and then we had something called Foden Machinery, which is awful.
Foden Machinery?
No, Foden Machinery. Apparently, there's a truck called a Foden. And I can remember it somewhere, it said Foden Machinery. And we thought, that'd be good. But this is probably at the time of prog rock, you know, and you'd have... it wouldn't be out of place. And so anyway, Diamond Head came along, and I thought, that's a good name. And the drummer, Duncan, thought, yeah, that's a good name. And then once Sean joined...
Sean Harris, the singer.
Yeah, we auditioned a couple of guys from school, because I just went around school. We hadn't left school yet, you know. It's probably the last few months of school. We'd have left around June 1976. And I would say, can you sing, you know? And some of them would go, yeah, I can sing, you know, bravado. And I'd come down and I'd play the guitar and I'd sit there with the mic and, yeah. And then I'd go, no, I can't sing. Oh, they'd be terrified, you know, the nerves would get the better of them. And then one guy said, Sean Harris can sing. I heard him sing on a school trip. He's got a good voice. And I thought, oh, okay. So I just went up to Sean Harris, who I knew, but we weren't like in a clique or good mates. And I said, can you sing? I've heard you can sing because I've got a band. Do you want to come and sing for the band? Ever so innocent and, you know. And he said... Yeah, right, you know. And so he literally came down and I played the acoustic guitar and he made up a song on the spot. And I thought, that's it, he's the man, that's it. Just call off the dogs. Okay, so this is Lights Out by UFO, and this contains Michael Schenker, who was one of the most influential guitarists probably in the world, but especially to me. I think he's an absolutely incredible player, and I still love his style today. So, the solos in this are just outstanding.
Is he the reason that you play Flying V?
It is. I went to see UFO in 1979 on the Obsession Tour, and on comes Michael Schenker with the white Flying V and blonde hair and a black outfit, and I just thought, wow, he looks good. I'm having that. So that was my next goal, to buy a white Flying V.
Was it expensive?
It's expensive, yeah. Crazy. I mean, I think it was £495 back in 1980 or 1979. And so that's a lot of money then.
So how did you pay for it?
I'd saved. I was working. I was an apprentice car mechanic, vehicle mechanic. And so I was still living with my parents, so I had no real overheads. And I just saved and saved. I've always been a good saver. And I've got enough money together to buy this Flying V. I'd already bought a Fender Strat before that. But it didn't quite have the sound I was looking for, you know. And the V was a bit more powerful with the dub, you know, the humbuckers and stuff. And, once I got the V, it's an image, isn't it? You know, and you've got to be pretty good to play a Flying V, I think. It's quite a ballsy statement to go on stage with a white Flying V. So, you know, you've got to be able to play.
Also, it doesn't feel... That comfortable on your thigh,
no,
right?
No, it doesn't.
Because it's the way it's shaped.
Yeah, I. It's difficult to practice on. I never practice on a V now. I always practice on a Les Paul because it sits better. Whereas the V's great on stage. But, yeah, if you put it between your legs, within half an hour you've got backache. So it's awful to practice with. I don't think they intended it to be sat down with it. They intended it to be stood up wearing a strap.
Maybe that's why Michael Schenker is so angry. he was on this podcast, actually, and he got very upset. The first thing he told me was, I don't want to talk about the Scorpions. And then he constantly brings them up.
You know, he's got beef with the Scorpions, yeah.
Yes, I asked him if, he came from a very musically gifted family, as his sister is also a musician.
Right.
And he was like, Rudolf has no talent.
Ouch.
Diamond Head is usually, you know, counted as one of the most important bands of the new wave of British heavy metal. Did people use that expression back then? Is it like something that...
Well, it's the expression appeared in 1979.
That early?
Yes, that early. And it kind of tied in, because all these bands around the UK were doing heavy metal, because we'd all been to see Black Sabbath and Judas Priest and AC/DC and Rush and Rainbow and Whitesnake or Motorhead. So we'd all been to the, you know, a band would tour the country. And we knew there were great bands, UFO amongst them, Thin Lizzy. And so you just wanted to do that, really. You wanted to emulate your heroes. And I always thought, what a great job, you know, being on stage in a band that looks fantastic, you know. So you form your own band and you off you go. You try and write songs. You got these riffs and all that. And then you have no idea how to get from A to B, how to get a record deal, how to become a big band, how to play festivals and go abroad. But you have a go. And then 3 years down the line, we formed in 76 and in 79, the new wave of British heavy metal appeared in Sounds. And then you suddenly realise, oh, there's a band in Sheffield called Def Leppard. And then, oh, there's a band in London called Angel Witch. And you think, oh, we're all doing the same sort of thing. We're all slightly different, which is fantastic. You know, it's easy to tell the difference between, say, Tigers of Pantangan and Angel Witch. But we're all doing heavy metal. And so that brought us all together. And then certain rock clubs would suddenly have a new wave of British heavy metal night. And we'd be able to go around the country. We'd be able to play Bradford and Sunderland and London. And we'd get to know each other. We'd go and watch other bands, or we'd support other bands. So that movement happened very quickly. And it also meant, you know, I realised it meant we could possibly get a record deal, because Def Leppard got signed to Phonogram, Iron Maiden got signed to EMI, Saxon got signed to Kerrang! And I thought, oh, right, now that's how it's going to work then. Somebody will come and check Diamond Head out, because I thought we were good. You know, we're a great singer, we had some great songs. I thought we'd definitely... Because I remember going to watch Def Leppard support Sammy Hagar at the Birmingham Odeon, and I thought, we're as good as he is. They're good, but we're as good. We're the same age. When we're as good as these, and I thought we could get a record deal here, you know. So it very inspiring time, and it was quite competitive, because I think everybody was after a record deal. That's all you could think of. The goal in life was get a record deal, you know. And I don't think we realised the work involved after you got a record deal, but it seemed like that was the goal, and we just moved towards that achievement.
How come your lead singer Sean Harris's mother and her boyfriend became your management? That's quite odd.
It is quite odd. Okay, so we had four lots of managers. We had a school friend called Steve, then he got superseded by another chap called Tim, then we had two other people. One, again, was a school friend, but he knew somebody called Dave Morris, and he'd been around the block a bit, so he started getting us further afield, and I think at some point... Sean's mom started getting involved, and she brought in her partner, this guy called Reg, who owned a factory where we went and rehearsed and things like that.
Was she very into music?
No, not really. I think she just thought her son was talented. And
so she was a stage mom?
I guess so. She probably thought... he could do something here, you know. Because it was three kids, Sean... Teresa and Darren, and Sean had the lion's share of talent. Yeah, the other two didn't really show any potential for stardom. So Sean became the goose that laid golden eggs, you know, and all the attention went on to Sean. So I suppose she sort of was looking out for Sean, didn't want him to get, you know, ripped off, if you like. But ultimately wasn't a good thing, because she had no experience whatsoever. Neither did Reg. They'd never done this before. They were learning on the job. So here's us, a very young, naive band, and we're being guided by management who hadn't got a clue what they were doing, really. They were just picking up bits of information here and there. And everybody was telling them that Diamond did a fantastic band. You know, you've really got potential here. I mean, one magazine said we were the next Led Zeppelin, you know. That's quite a claim that somebody who knows what they're talking about said that. You know, it's not just your mate. It's one of the journalists in Sounds.
Who wrote the lyrics at that time?
Sean.
Sean did?
Yeah, Sean was the lyric. I would very often do the music, but he was involved in the music as well. But all the lyrics were Sean. Yeah, absolutely.
I just find it kind of interesting that, you know, his mother was so controlling, and then your biggest song, Am I Evil, starts with... My mother was a witch, she was burned alive, thankless little bitch for the tears I cried. It's about someone with a very complicated relationship with his mother, to say the least.
Yes.
And she gets burned at the stake and he goes on a rampage killing spree to avenge her.
I'm not sure what that meant psychologically.
But I mean, how did his mom feel about those lyrics?
She probably was a little bit perturbed, but realise it's just heavy metal, it's just music. And Sean said, once I came up with that monster riff, he needed to come up with something dark that fitted, you know. So he came up with My Mother Was a Witch and all that. And it's a very extreme lyric for the time. And I think a lot of kids jumped on that and thought, oh, my mother was a witch. So, you know, we definitely got that absolutely bang on.
But did she go on tour with you as well?
Sometimes, yeah. But the way we toured was pretty low-key. We'd be in a car, the band, with this guy John, who was kind of our tour manager, road manager. And then there'd be three guys in a van with the gear. So there wasn't really room for Linda. And I mean, in a way, she's a mom. She's got two other kids. She's keeping the house and look after the dogs and all that. So she'd pretty much stay at home.
And she wasn't worried that you would, like, drink alcohol on the road?
Not really.
No,
it wasn't that controlling.
No.
I think we were just, you know, we didn't have a tour bus or anything. It was all just, we only really went around the UK. We didn't even get over to Europe till 83, and then it was patchy, you know. So it's not like we went to the States for 6 months or something. It was all a bit low-key. It took us so long to get a record deal.
Because they decided that you would record your first album on your own and press it.
Yeah, it was Reggie's idea, that was. It wasn't Linda's idea. It was Reggie's idea. So what happened was we recorded a single in December, I think, 1979, and Shoot Out the Lights, at this local studio in Worcester. And released, I think we did 1,500 copies, and then you could send them out to journalists and clubs and help you get more gigs. And then we still hadn't got a record deal at that point. I think several companies had made overtures, but Reg was sort of holding out for the big record deal. He'd probably read somewhere that Led Zeppelin signed for £200,000 to Atlantic Records, so we're going to do that. We're going to have a big 5-album record deal. And realistically, nah, we're not going to do that. What we were being offered were like a singles deal where you'd do two singles, and if they went well, they might do an album, or they have the option to do an album or drop you, you see. And Reg wasn't satisfied with that. I think he was a bit naive that he thought Diamondhead's the next big thing and we could hold out for whatever we wanted. And eventually we signed to MCA. But not till 1st of January 1982, and by which time the new Every British Heavy Metal is like almost a good three years old, and a lot of the fire and wind has gone out of its sail by that point. They're probably onto the next big thing, magazines like Sounds. But anyway, you know, we ploughed on, and
And you sold those copies that you pressed yourself?
Yeah.
Through an ad in Sounds magazine.
That's right. So we pressed 1,000 copies. I think it was Reggie's idea to make an album. He said we could sell it ourselves at gigs and put an advert in Sounds. So he paid for 6 adverts in Sounds, week for 6 weeks. And you could buy the album for £3.50, mail order. And so we did that and sent them out from Sean's house.
Is it true that you never paid for that ad and kind of got sued by apparently, Sounds?
Yeah. That's apparently because we must have had a company that Red set up called Diamond Head Management or something. And I think, Spotlight Publications tried to sue us for the money. I suppose they paid up.
It must have been quite, a small sum to sue someone over.
Stupid? Really? I don't understand why they didn't pay the bill. And you risk making an enemy of the most important music paper in the UK for bands like Diamond. I'm only 19 at this point. I don't really understand what's going on. And in hindsight, it just sounds ridiculous.
But someone who actually bought a copy of the album from Sounds magazine, from the ad, was Lars Ulrich.
Absolutely.
So he was 17 years old, living in California.
Yeah.
And he just sees this ad.
Yeah. He used to get Sounds sent over to LA, and he must have seen the ad, yeah. I think he was, into the new wave of British heavy metal. He'd probably been reading about all these new bands. And then one week, the advert would appear, and you'd think, oh, okay, I'll send for that. Sent for it, and then I can remember that we had this conversation back then, and we thought, oh, somebody in America's ordered a copy of the album. So we had to send one to America. We've got a fan in America, not realizing that this guy, Lars Ulrich, which not very American sounded name, but we thought that's amazing. We got a fan in America. So I think he was probably the first guy to order it in America. And then he wrote back to the fan club address and said, I love the album and I'm going to come over and see the band, because we'd probably got a tour booked in the summer of 81. And he came over and saw us at the Woolwich Odeon and introduced himself. And we thought, oh, brilliant. He's that guy who's come over from San Francisco, from LA, to see us. And nobody'd ever done that before. He was a 17-year-old kid and he's come all the way over from Los Angeles to see Diamond Head. And we thought, wow, that's such a lot of commitment. I mean, it's expensive. I don't think my mum and dad would have lent me the money or give me, if I'd said, I'm going to go and watch a band in Los Angeles, I'm going to fly over, they'd have gone, no, I don't think that's a very good idea.
Then again, your father wasn't a famous tennis player.
True. True, and probably not quite as liberal a family, where they may be bohemian lifestyle. That's exactly what happened, and he became a fan and a friend of the band, really.
And he ended up staying with you.
Yeah, we took him on board because he was only a young lad, and we probably thought he was a nice guy, looked out for him. And I remember saying, where are you going to sleep? And he stopped at my parents' house, and he slept on the floor in my bedroom in an old sleeping bag for a week. And then he went and slept on the couch at Sean's house for like 3 or 4 weeks. And during that time, we went to see Motorhead at the Heavy Metal Holocaust in Port Vale football ground. And
was that at the festival?
Yeah, a festival.
Metal Holocaust.
Yeah, Heavy Metal Holocaust. And
great festival name.
It was Motorhead and Blizzard of Oz. So I got to see Randy Rhoads. And it's a big gig. I mean, I bet there was...
And you went with Lars?
Yeah, me and Lars went on the train. I bet there was 30,000 people there. And Lars got us in free because he said he knew Lemmy. And he said, I'll be out of Blagosin, because we hadn't got tickets. So we get there he's a mouth-to-mouth, isn't he? So off he went. And next thing you know, he came back with two tickets. So that was great.
And that was before he started Metallica.
Way before. I think once he'd hung out with Diamond Head, and, he knew Motörhead and etc. But I think he went back to the States, placed the ad in Recycler, and got in touch with James.
And Metallica, of course, have been huge Diamond Head fans for a very long time. They famously covered Am I Evil on the B-side of Creeping Death in 1984.
Yes.
How much has that meant to you financially?
It's been a lifeline, It's been absolutely crucial. I've been getting royalties from Metallica for the four songs that they've covered over the years, since about 1990, 91. So that's absolutely kept me alive. You know, I've been able to buy the house, and it's made a world of difference to me and Sean, you know, because we co-wrote those songs, so we both get publishing royalties. But let me just say that I realised the other day that Metallica opened for Saxon at the Whiskey Go Go in 82. And they played three Diamond Head songs in the set, opening for Saxon.
And that was way before Diamond Head had come to the US.
Way before. Diamond Head didn't set foot in the US till 2002.
And you sort of returned the favor by covering Metallica's No Remorse.
Yeah.
4 years ago.
That's right, on the 2020 recorded version of Lightning to the Nations. That's right. We thought we'll re-record the album, but I thought let's do some covers as well to make it extra special, bonus, different to the original. And I thought, yeah, let's do a Metallica song, you know. And I listened through to a lot of the material, and I thought that's got a certain Diamond Head DNA quality to it. It's a little bit like Diamond Head in places. I didn't want to do Seek and Destroy because I thought it's too famous. Everybody knows that one inside out. But I thought No Remorse is a great song.
And you actually made it heavier, you know.
I tried to. Tried to. Well, we probably, you know, technology's moved on a lot, hasn't it, since 83. And we probably had more time to record it than they did. They put it down pretty quickly, didn't they? They were on the own little label then, weren't they, like Music for Nations or... Metal, what was it called, that label? Megaforce or something. And I thought No Remorse would be good. I wanted to do some of it off the first album because they only covered songs off Diamond Head's first album, Lightning to the Nations. So I thought it makes sense for us to do one off their first album.
Why did you decide to re-record your first album?
It was an anniversary idea. 2010 was the 30th anniversary of Lightning to the Nation. So we did some shows where we'd play the whole album. And then we had a discussion at probably 2019. And Carl, the drummer, said, you know, we could just do some shows, 40th anniversary. Or we could re-record the album with this lineup and modern production and all that. And we toyed with the idea and thought, okay, let's have a go. And if it's not very good, we can knock it on the head. We can tell no one and just say, it didn't work. But as soon as we started doing it, and we did the covers, and you know, as soon as we started playing No Remorse, it sounded great in rehearsal. So we just thought, yeah, it's going to work.
The master tapes to your first album disappeared in the 80s.
Yes, not the multi-tracks, but the stereo master. Yeah, the mixed stereo master. Yeah, they did. They disappeared. Our manager, Reg, foolishly sent them over to Germany to a label called Wolf Records, and they never returned them. And so... They apparently never sent any royalties or any royalty statement. And they never even sent the master tapes back. So the only copy, we hadn't even got safety copies. You know, that's how naive, well, we all were, I suppose. But, so anyway, scroll forward to 1989. And Lars Ulrich decided to do a compilation album of... 1979 Revisited. Oh, it might have been 1999, I can't remember. And him and Jeff Barton compiled this double album, and he called me and said, where's the master tapes for Lightning to the Nations, because we want to do this project? And I told him this little story about it had been
lost in Germany.
Yeah, lost in Germany by King's X. And I said, it's in Germany, it's at Wolf Records, it's this guy. I forgot his name, and he said okay. So apparently he called Phonogram Germany and said, we need this album back, can you send somebody round to his house? And they did, and somebody must have knocked on his door and said, hello, I've come for the Diamond Head tapes, And he must have gone, oh, all right. And he went and found them. Perhaps he realised, I've got them, but nobody's asked me for them, you know. Sometimes that's the way, isn't it? You don't give something back unless they ask for it. And he must have found them and given them to the guy. And then next thing I know, Lars calls and says, yeah, we've got the tapes. He says, well, I'll do the new version, copy it, and then I'll make sure it gets back to you. And so I said, thank you very much. And then, true to his word, they sent the tapes back, and so I have them safe and sound in the house.
How long did you work with that management? And did they, like, object to you if you tried to, you know, fire them?
Well, we couldn't fire them, really, because it was Sean's mother, and he was loyal to his mom. And even though MCA didn't like them and thought they were out of their depth, that's what they described them as. And at one point, they said, well, either you change management or we will drop you. And yet we still ignored their advice. Mainly Sean. Sean became the leader. And so I couldn't really, you know. And they sent a manager to see us once to get to know us and see if we liked each other. And Sean was prickly and didn't want to talk to him and turned up late and in a funny mood. And it was obvious what he was doing. He said to me, my mother is the best manager in the world. And at that point, I just thought, oh, I can't do anything with this. I'm dead. It's not. Sean is so loyal.
So they were very close.
They must be.
Because he was the golden...
Yeah, the golden child.
Yeah.
And, you know, his mum and dad split up, so his mother was the figurehead. And
did she keep working in the music business?
No, of course not. She hadn't got a clue. So it's the minute Diamond had stopped, that's it. She's just back to being a housewife. Now, it's not like she went on to manage Coldplay or something.
Sean Harris still does some solo work. Does he work with her still? Or no, she's
dead.
She's dead. Okay.
They're both dead. The manager, Reg, and Linda, they're both dead now. But he did really after about 1990, he did an album with Robin George called Notorious. And since then, he's done nothing. He's not made a record or... He don't do any gigs or anything. It's a shame, you know, in a way. He's super talented.
It's quite unusual for parents to be a part of, like, metal groups mm-hmm. like that. And it made me think of, you know, the Swedish band Bathory, where the guy who, like, wrote all the music, Quarton, worked closely with his father.
Right.
His father produced all the albums. Nearly all the albums.
That's unusual.
They have, you know, a very, very tight working relationship.
Well, if it's good, it could work. You know, obviously, I've been a professional musician for a long, long time. So if I had a son who was in a band, I would want to advise him. I wouldn't necessarily want to be the manager, but I would want to help and advise. But I've had experience. I've been doing it for over 40 years, whereas Linda hadn't got a clue. She didn't know anybody in the industry. And whenever someone suggested you should get better management or I'm sure, I mean, Peter Mensch came to have a look at us in...
Who was that?
Peter Mensch, who manages Metallica.
Oh,
and at the time he was with Lieber Krebs and they managed AC/DC and the Scorpions and Michael Schenker. And he came to have a look at Diamond Head because the word was from the journalist, Diamond Head is brilliant, you know, they're going to be huge. So he had a look at us and he had a meeting with us, but he walked away because I think he worked out that I'm not going to be able to get the singer away from his mother. So he managed a band called Def Leppard instead, you know.
That went quite well.
It went well. Yes. I think he made the right choice. This is Highway Star by Deep Purple, because this is one of my favourite songs, but also it's got one of my all-time favourite guitar solos by Richie Blackmore. And I when I was like maybe 14, 15, I wanted to play like that. And this is one of the songs that inspired me to want to play and want to practice and want to get good.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
When you released your third album, Canterbury, you started to experiment a bit with more progressive sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I, according to Wikipedia, the recordings put such a strain on the band that Sean Harris had a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
What happened to him?
It was, I don't know if it was an actual nervous breakdown, but I can remember it rocking backwards and forwards in the toilet. It's probably not a good thing. And he had to get his mom down. So we're in London, we're at Battery Studios in Willesden. And his mum's up at home in the Midlands, and his girlfriend was with us, and she'd been helping out cooking and things. And she had to phone home and go, "Mother, you know, Sean's not doing very well. He won't come out of the toilets, you know." And I didn't know what to think. I mean, Sean's a mate, you know. We've been through a lot together. I've known him since I was five, and I have no idea what to say to him. I've not come across someone having a nervous breakdown before. I think the pressure of Diamond Head, in a way, Sean was a bit black and white. It either had to be the greatest album in the world or it's rubbish, you see. So I think we went in with the intention to make this masterpiece. And because it's obviously at this point wasn't going to be the greatest album in the world, he started to freak out a little bit and back away. And maybe I think each time his brain would then start thinking, okay, what do we do next? And there are times when we've been working together where he even want to finish the album because he'd want to move on to the next album because he realised this isn't the one, which is an awful way to be, you know, never satisfied. And people are relying on you to finish the thing, and you've already spent a load of money on it. So, yeah, I mean, we lost Colin and Duncan at that point. So the band had split in two. So it was a real shame because the band had been functioning really well. We'd done some fantastic gigs and we'd had an album in the charts. We got this record deal. And then all of a sudden it split into two and we're struggling to finish it. It was a real tough time. We'd spent a fortune on this studio we were using in Willesden was like £1,000 a day or something. Def Leppard had spent, I think, 9 months in there doing Pyromania. And, you know, we came in right after them. But it was a tough, tough album to make. And it almost killed us completely, you know. But we managed to finish it. Getting another drummer and bass player and then do some shows. You know, we supported Black Sabbath and things. But the band was never the same. You know, I always thought, okay, if, you know, Duncan's gone, we're getting another drummer, a better drummer. Because we auditioned. I auditioned the drummer. Sean wasn't involved in the auditions. He didn't want to be. And I auditioned 130 drummers. And so we got a really good drummer in. But
you auditioned 130 drummers?
Yes, which must have been a
tedious job to listen to. God.
Every single drummer wanted to change the kit. Like, they'd come in and they'd say, I've just got to reset the kit for me. You know, like the toms, I want the toms there, and I want the hi-hats got to be there. And so they'd fuck about for like 10, 15 minutes. And then I'd just get them to play a groove. And I could tell within four bars if they were any good. I had to whittle it down to the top three in a way, and then we got this guy Robbie, but yeah, he was a better drummer, but Diamond Head was no better for it, because Diamond Head had a magic with those four guys, and we didn't appreciate what we had. There was a limitation to it, to what Duncan and Colin could play, but in a way they were giving freedom for Sean and I to shine on top. You know, if all four of you are trying to be the man and overplay, it can be a bit of a mess.
So in what year did you break up?
We split in half in 1983, okay, while we were making Canterbury, which was traumatic. And then we split all together in 1985. Because we got dropped, you see, we were dropped in 84. And then without that support and money, the band fizzled out. Because people want paying, don't they? They want wages. You couldn't hold it together.
And what did you do for the rest of the 80s?
Oh, it was a tough time. Tough time. I didn't know what to do. We'd got a studio in the Midlands that Reg had built for us to record. And I started using that, and I started recording my own songs, but also I started recording other bands. Local bands would come in, I'd be the producer, and we did that, and I had another band called Radio Moscow, and we did a few gigs, but it didn't really get a lot of attention, and most people would just say, why don't you reform Diamond Head? That's what I was constantly getting, until we did in 1990. Then we spent about 2.5 years making an album called Death and Progress. We only got a little deal with it on a company called Castle Communications. That came out in 1993. We opened for Metallica at Milton Keynes Bowl.
Which was a huge concert.
60,000 people. And by then, Metallica were name-checking Diamond Head hundreds and hundreds of times into press all over the world. So we'd had a bit of a re-interest. You know, they'd covered three Diamond Head songs by this point, Am I Evil, Helpless and The Prince. And Diamond Head was considered an influential band, a cool band from the New Wobbuhem period.
And lots of other bands started to name-check you as well, I think. But did you always, you know, see or hear the influence? Have there been times when you've heard new bands and they say that, yeah, Diamond Head were super influenced to us, and maybe you don't really get, you know, what they've picked up on?
I suppose Lars always said it was the epic. He said he said something like, we had the heavy power from Motorhead, but we had the epic. Because Metallica like long songs, don't they? They do 6, 7, 8 minutes. Yeah,
they can
songs.
Be quite progressive, you know.
Yeah, and I think they apparently got that from Diamond Head, because it's a song like The Prince, 6 minutes. Helpless is 6.5. Am I Evil, 7.5. Sucking My Love is 9.5. So they obviously thought, you know, Heaven from Hell, Borrowed Time, the long songs, and I think they liked that. It's not just 3 minutes, let's have a hit single. It was, let's write a classic, epic song.
Am I Evil was number 26 when Rolling Stone magazine did a list of the 100 greatest heavy metal tracks of all time. And they wrote that it remains a masterclass in heavy metal dynamics, from its doomy militaristic intro to its rising and falling central riff.
That's a fantastic compliment, isn't it? Considering it was never on a proper release or anything, it's become a massive song, very influential. And I think dynamics are very hard to write in songs. You have to write them into the song. I don't know how we did it almost. Sean and I worked very well together back in the day, and we managed to conjure up some magic.
And the intro, that militaristic riffing in the beginning of the song, almost has like a classical feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
It reminds me of classical music.
Yes.
Oh, it's thinking of
distinctive as well. The second you hear that, dun, 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 you know exactly what it is.
Yeah, it made me think of a track that you used as an intro during your concert, Gustav Holst's piece, Mars,
yes, Mars,
The Bringer of War.
That's where it
Which is from 1914.
From. Yeah, 1914. Yeah, I remember listening to that and thinking, that's fantastic, I'd like to do something like that. And I mean,
which famously influenced John Williams' music from Star Wars.
Right, well, it's got that flattened fifth, dark yeah. tone to it, hasn't it? It's mean and moody. And yeah, when we were writing Am I Evil, I remember we had the verse part where it would go, you know, E, B, back to E and up to A. And but at some point, I suddenly thought, we could put that intro on with the dun, 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 dun. And we worked all that out. It's a different rhythm, you know. Apparently Mars is like dun, diddly, dun, 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 diddly, dun, dun. Whereas Am I Evil is dun, 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 which is a much simpler version. And I always think it sounds a little, you know, School's Out by Alice Cooper. And they get to that bit, goes, see, it's pretty much like that. Or it's a bit like Child in Time, the middle eight of that. So we must have came up with a different rhythm that we borrowed from somewhere, and we had those notes, which is a bit like Mars. But, you know, Zeppelin did, you know, there's something similar in Friends off Zeppelin 3, where they use that kind of scale. And Rainbow, the start of Eyes of the World, has a similar kind of pattern to the Gustav Holst one. So it would have all just gone in and come out again. As I'd have thought, that'd be a great intro.
You briefly reunited in the 2000s.
Yeah.
With the Sean Harris.
Yeah.
But then he decided that he wanted to change the band's name
yeah.
to Host.
Host.
That's a very odd name. Host. Why Host?
I don't know why Host. But yes, we started making an album. We got back together and did some gigs. And then at some point, Sean announced we could do a new album. You know, he says, I've got loads of songs and all that. So we wrote some more. I think I co-wrote 5 songs with him. And the rest was Sean's songs that he'd been writing for the past 20 years. And we went in the studio, booked the studio as Diamond Head. And, you know, we went in and started. And halfway through the recording, he said, I don't want to call it Diamond Head. I want to call it Host. And we were all a bit shocked at this because I thought, shh, you can't change the name of the band. The band's got, you know, it's not like we're huge and we could absorb.
But if you've got Metallica name-checking yeah. you the whole time, you know, you kind yeah. of lose that connection if you yeah. call yourself something
it's
else.
It's like starting from scratch yeah. almost. And I argued with Sean for about 3 months trying to persuade him out of this madness. He was adamant he wanted to call it Host. So in the end, we finished the album and I said, okay, well, if you want to call it Host, you get a record deal, you know, you go and get a record deal, you know, go to Sanctuary Records or whatever and say, this is the album. We want X amount of money for it, but it's not called Diamond, it's a Host album. And nothing happened. So months and months were wasted and I thought, what the hell, you know. So eventually, after about a year or so, I thought we should get another singer, you know. A couple of people suggested it. I mean, it seemed a massively crazy thing to do at the time. Really, Sean Harris, get a different singer. Diamond was a different but I thought, we're getting nowhere here. Nothing's being done. He won't budge off this idea of calling it Host. Nobody wants to do the album as Host. Or nobody even wants to give us any money. So we would not even cover the cost of making it, let alone make any profit for spending all that time recording it. So it was just madness. It went on and on. And I just thought, I'm going to get another singer. And
so did you audition 120 singers?
Unfortunately, we didn't have that kind of luxury. So it was just a guy from the Midlands who our drummer spotted and said he was good. You know, I think they did rock and roll, Led Zepp. And he thought, well, if he can sing that, that's not an easy song. So we tried him out and we thought, yeah, great. I mean, you know, no Sean Harris, but such a nice guy and so easy to work with compared to Sean. Sean could be very difficult to work with, and This was a guy who was prepared to say yes to things rather than no. This is Problem Child by AC/DC, and I've always been a fan of AC/DC since I first saw them on the Old Grey Whistle Test, probably 76, and they played this song. It was a little film clip, probably from Australia. I don't know if they'd been over to the UK. They might have been over once or twice, but I hadn't seen them, and I sort of fell in love with them and Angus Young. I thought it was a star. I couldn't take my eyes off him. So I went to see them in 77 on the Let There Be Rock tour. And I've been a fan ever since. And I think one of the greatest live bands of all time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
How did you get in touch with your current lead singer, Rasmus Boom Anderson?
Okay.
He's from Denmark. It's amazing how much Danish people have meant to Diamond Head.
That's a good point. Yes, it was purely, we needed a, we're looking for another singer because our singer, Nick, the guy we took on after Sean, had emigrated to Brisbane in 2008. So we started to think it's too expensive to fly him backwards and forwards. So we thought we need somebody who lives in England. So our bass player's friend knew of Rasmus, who said, I think they went to college together or something in London. And she said, I know a good rock singer. And so he came and auditioned, and we sent him a tape, and he sent back a vocal. I think a Diamond Head song, he sang on it. And I just thought, yeah, he's great. It's holding notes, and it didn't sound difficult. He made it sound easy. We auditioned him. And we had some dates in the diary, so we just said, yeah, great, do these dates and we'll see how it goes. And then sort of halfway through the tour, we said, we think you're great. Do you want to join the band? And he said yes. So he's been in the band 10 years now.
And he's actually 4 years younger than your debut album.
Yeah. Is he?
He's born in...
Was he 84?
He was born in 1984, I think. Raz.
So he's the album came out in 1980, so he's 4 years older.
He was born. Raz was born in 1984.
Yeah.
So, and the album came out in 1980. So yes. He's 4 years younger than the album, right?
Is he? Oh, okay. I see what you mean. Yes, I see what you mean. Never mind, strong subject.
Never mind. But he also he produces your stuff, and he has written the lyrics for the last Diamond Head album.
Yeah, Coffin Train.
Yeah, yes. I really enjoyed the track Belly of the Beast, which seems to be about drug addiction.
I'm not quite sure what it's about. He likes kind of you know, not being too obvious and a bit fantasy. So half the time, I don't know what he's singing about. Sometimes I wish he'd pick a subject and stick to it a bit more. But, you know, we're all different. We've all got style.
And for the past year, you've toured with the Saxon.
Uh-huh.
How did you first meet those guys?
Well, I've met them over the years. We played together at a festival in 2002, and then I've met them at various gigs over the years, even at an airport here and there and stuff like that. So we were aware of each other. You know, I've always known about Saxon. They've always known about Diamond Head. And then we started to share the same management in 2018. And so we got more and more gigs. And so now Diamond Head have probably done about 40 gigs opening for Saxon. We did a big tour end of last year. And then in the summer of last year, the manager called me and said, Paul Quinn's got COVID and we've got this gig coming up on the Saturday, the following weekend. Would you be interested in learning the set and doing the gig? And I said, yeah, okay, great, fantastic. So I set about doing that. Then they told me, he's going to be okay for the gig, but thanks for learning the set. And then after that, I thought, oh, that's interesting. Maybe Paul will get ill again one day, and they might phone me and say, Paul can't do that gig. Would you be? Because I'd obviously been willing to learn the set. You know, they knew I was a nice guy. I've made a start. You know, they knew I'd got the set under my belt. So I think when it came to picking a new guitarist, I think Biff decided that I'd be the man for the job because they thought, well, he learned the set, you know, he's from our period, he's roughly the same age, he can write songs. I've co-written every Diamond Head song since 1976, and a nice guy, you know. So I think that's how it happened. And then in March of this year, I got the call to say, Paul Quinn is stepping down from Saxon. Would I be interested in taking his place?
But he hasn't left the band. He still writes stuff for Saxon.
Yeah, I mean, they want him to write. And he's played on the new album. But I don't think he wrote anything because he's busy with his band, The Cards. And you know, we've been doing festivals and there just wasn't a period where I think Paul and Saxon could get together, really. So once I came on board, Biff wanted to know if I'd got anything. He said, we're doing a new album. Have you got any ideas? So I sent Biff a load of my ideas. So he'd already got ideas from Nibs and Doug, and he could add to that my ideas as well. So we've got even more choice now. And I think it probably helps make the album a little bit stronger.
Yeah. Last question. Back in 1991, the Canadian pop group Men Without Hats recorded an instrumental track called Life After Diamond Head. What was that about?
I don't know, is the short answer. I've heard of it, and I don't know what they're talking about. If they're talking about the band Diamond Head, so be it. But I don't know. I don't think I've even heard it. But if it's about us, that's fantastic.
Well, Brian, many thanks for coming here.
Thank you.
And yeah, good luck with both Saxon and Diamond Head.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Den här podcasten producerades av Daniel Bäckström för Leon Media. Brian Tattler från Diamond Head var hemma hos Jager.